audio for own use of Saved by the Light. The true story of a man who died twice and the profound revelations he received. Danyon Brinkley. With Paul Berry. With an introduction by Raymond Moody, M.D. Foreword to the new edition by Paul Berry. The 76-year-old American author and speaker is famously known for surviving three separate near-death experiences, NDEs, most notably an intense 1975 lightning strike that left him clinically dead for nearly 30 minutes. He frequently speaks to media outlets, including detailed retrospective interviews in mid-2025 about his life, his best-selling book Saved by the Light, and his spiritual outlook on the afterlife. Life, transforming him from a self-described childhood bully into a dedicated hospice volunteer. Each event occurred under different medical circumstances and provided him with distinct spiritual lessons. The first NDE, 1975, the lightning strike. The event, on September 17, 1975, Brinkley was speaking on the telephone during a thunderstorm at his home. A lightning bolt struck the phone line, sending thousands of volts through his head and spine, throwing him into the air, and welding the nails of his shoes to the floor. A medical status: his heart stopped, and he was pronounced clinically dead for 28 minutes before unexpectedly waking up in a hospital morgue. A the experience: Brinkley reported leaving his body, floating through a dark tunnel, and entering a crystal city of light. There, he encountered 13 angelic beings in a cathedral of knowledge who showed him a panoramic review of his life, here forcing him to feel the pain he had inflicted on others. They also gave him 117 prophetic visions of the future. A the second NDE, 1989, open heart surgery. The event, 14 years after his lightning strike, Brinkley suffered severe heart failure, stemming in part from the long-term physical trauma of the original electrocution. He had to undergo emergency open heart surgery. A medical status: he experienced major complications during the procedure and once again clinically died on the operating table. A the experience: during this second journey to the afterlife, Brinkley was reunited with the spiritual beings. According to his book Saved by the Light, they gave him a specific mandate: he was to return to Earth and use his experiences to comfort those who were afraid of dying. This directly inspired his lifelong mission in hospice care and veteran advocacy. A the third NDE, 1997, brain surgery. The event: Brinkley faced yet another health crisis when he suffered a brain aneurysm, requiring complex, high-risk brain surgery. Medical status: he suffered a third clinical death during the surgical procedure before being successfully resuscitated. The experience: this final experience is detailed in his book Secrets of the Light. Brinkley stated that this NDE focused heavily on the mechanics of human consciousness and deepened his understanding of the transition between life and death. He emerged from it with an even stronger conviction that love is the true currency of life and that death is simply a peaceful transition, not an end. This book is dedicated to the doctors, nurses, and volunteers who perform the valuable work of hospice. Also to my family, the Brinkleys, and especially to Dr. Raymond Moody. Foreword. In the summer of 1992, driven by a need to understand what happens when we die, I set out to find a person who had gone far into the realm of the dead and returned to tell about it. These people are known as a near-death experiencer, so A N D E R S E R, and I began to search for the best, the one who could tell the most about what the afterlife is like. I began my search with Raymond Moody, M.D., Ph.D., the recognized father of near-death studies. As a young medical student, Dr. Moody became curious about life after death after hearing the story of Dr. George R. Ritchie. Ritchie had died of pneumonia in an army hospital in Texas in 1946. As doctors covered him with a sheet and prepared to send him to the morgue, Ritchie claims to have taken an out-of-body voyage across the country, flying at great speed past to and even through several landmarks that he was able to identify later. Eventually, in a sort of a Ritchie returned to his body. Moody heard Richie tell his story to a philosophy class, and was hooked. He began collecting similar stories of near-death experiences, ones that he converted into a wonderfully insightful and philosophical book entitled Life After Life. I had written a book with Moody called The Light Beyond, and through the work I had done with this brilliant doctor, I had become more and more entranced by the subject of near-death experiences. I joked that my life was firmly steeped in death, and it was. But I still wanted to go deeper into the subject to really understand what it was like to die and return to life. I decided the best way to further my education about the topic was to focus on one persona TMS story, a single great NDE. "A.O. Raymond, I need help," A.I. said, visiting the good doctor at his magnificent mill house in Oxford, Alabama. "A.O. need to find the best near-death experience you at ever known. A generous as ever, Moody began revealing his top picks. He told me some fascinating stories about different people who had died and visited the afterlife before mentioning an NDE named Danyon Brinkley. "Brinkley at TMS was the best near-death experience he at TMD ever heard," said Moody. My ears instantly perked up. The two had met at a college near Aiken, South Carolina, where Moody had gone to speak about his near-death research. Brinkley told Moody his story. "He at TMD been struck by lightning while talking on the telephone. A bolt struck him behind the ear and traveled through his body with such power that the nails in his shoes welded to the nails in the floor. He was thrown into the air and landed on the bed, which collapsed to the floor from the force. As emergency medical technicians worked over his body, Brinkley began a long and intricate trip to the other world. He saw his life pass before him, witnessed everything he had ever done, both good and bad, and actually experienced the ramifications of his actions. For example, he felt the pain of a bullet he had fired during warfare as it blasted into the body of an enemy he had been sent to dispatch. Then he saw the effect that death had on the Marna TMS family and felt the grief of the Marna TMS wife." There were several more examples of Brinkley reliving the things he had done during his life, each more intriguing than the next. Then the story took a turn for the truly amazing. As Brinkley was given up for dead by the doctors, his body placed on a gurney that was bound for the morgue, he was shown the future by a number of angelic beings. One by one they came forward with boxes, opening them to reveal cryptic views of what was to happen in the coming decades. "I won't TMT ruin it for you now by describing the details presented to Brinkley, they are explained in the book ahead. I will say that Moody was stunned and puzzled by the accuracy of the information that was shown to the man who was, at the time, lying underneath a white sheet and considered dead by attending physicians. Moody told me a lot more about Brinkley at TMS life that afternoon. Brinkley had been involved in clandestine operations for the US government. He told Moody he worked as a contractor for the military, and he didn't TMT, mean he was building houses. But now, after his death experience, Brinkley was a changed man. He felt deep in his soul the need to do good on Earth. But he also was very conflicted. He had lived a violent life for so long," said Moody, "that even an audience with a host of angels couldn't TMT scare the demons out of him. I was completely sucked into this story and wanted to hear every last detail. I told Moody that I couldn't TMT wait to meet Danyon Brinkley. What happened next was one of many strange coincidences that presented itself in my relationship with Brinkley. Not 10 minutes later, a car rumbled into Moody at TMS gravel driveway, and a rough-looking character shot out of the driver at TMS seat. He looked like a cross between a blonde Elvis and Neil Cassady, the unnaturally wired driver in Jack Kerouac at TMS on the road. He burst into the house without a knock and began yelling at the top of his lungs, 'A.E.A.R. Amond, E.A.T.M.M. home.' He grabbed Moody like a bear and squeezed the air out of him. I scanned him as quickly as I could. What a presence he had. He was built like a defensive end, lean and raw-boned with a couple of scrapes on his arm that made him look like he had recently been on the playing field. He was wearing glasses that made his eyes look larger than they were, And when he turned and looked at me, it felt like I had been fixed on by some kind of jungle animal. There were no visible scars on his body that indicated he had ever been struck by lightning. But looking at him, I could certainly tell that something had happened to him. Aya, who the hell are you? Aya, he shouted, closing in on me. I couldn't tell if he was going to shake my hand or break it, and I wasn't sure if I should run or extend my hand. Luckily, Moody jumped in and introduced us. I was shaking with fear and excitement as I shook Brinkley's hand, and I didn't stop shaking that entire night. We all went to dinner at the Red Lobster, where Brinkley threatened me with a good pounding if I didn't just shut up and listen to his stories about the band of angels who had helped him see the future when he died. Moody could see from the worried look on my face that I was a bit overwhelmed. When Brinkley turned to talk to a waitress, Moody patted me on the shoulder. Ayo, he doesn't like strangers very much, eh, he said. Ayo, try to relax. He'll get used to you. It took a while, but Moody was right. The next day Brinkley calmed considerably. He began to tell me about life before his near-death experience, and the violent activities he had been involved in as AE4 in Contractora for the US government. After the lightning strike that nearly took his life after returning from a foreign mission, Brinkley could no longer raid or the dealer for the government. He was, as he put it, AE Amister completely changed by a phone call from God. It was the AE Amister that was difficult for Brinkley. In simple terms, he had sort of been a bad man before his a phone call from God. Afterwards, though, his brush with death and the vividly bizarre tour of the afterlife had compelled Brinkley to be a very good man. The result was a battle with both sides of his own psyche. Good and bad, yin and yang, Satan and God. It was the classic fight that many of us have daily, although I do think that Brinkley had more to work with, given what he had seen and done. It's kind of hard to know who I was and what I should be doing after getting a phone call from God, I said Brinkley. Ayo, just know I'm a different man and will be even more different as my life goes on. And then something utterly amazing happened. Brinkley began to read my mind. The mind reading was subtle at first. He would talk to me about something that was on my mind, a specific concerns I had about a book I was writing with Moody, or deeper thoughts I was having about my mother's illness or my wife and children. Somehow, he brought them up specifically at the moment when I was thinking them, as though he had heard my thoughts and was responding to a conversation we were having without me moving my lips. After it happened several times, I asked him how he was doing it. Ayo, it happened after my experience, Ayo, he said. Ayo found that I could touch people and see their lives or read their thoughts. Ayo, when he said Ayo see their lives, sir, he truly meant it. I found that to be true, when, on my third day at Moody's, Brinkley decided to demonstrate for me the magnitude of his psychic abilities. We sat in Moody's upstairs office and Brinkley began to talk quite normally and naturally about intimate details of my life. I have spent considerable time around psychics or people who think they are, and yet have found that the best way to discover if they are frauds is to respond as little as possible. By showing no emotion to what they say and by answering few if any of their questions, even the best frauds will fold if they get no feedback. I showed no emotion as Brinkley went on about my life. As far as I can remember, I said no more than 5 or 10 words during the hour that Brinkley told things about me that he could never have known. Inside, however, my heart was pounding and my mind racing as I realized that something truly bizarre was happening. I remembered everything I had learned about near-death experiences, especially research showing that NDERs have substantially more psychic experiences than the general population, and that they can be so profoundly changed by the experience that they struggle with their true identity for years to come. Brinkley embodied all of these things. I started thinking, was Brinkley the book subject I had been looking for? Was his story so compelling and true that readers would be able to see the good and the bad in the life-changing event known as the near-death experience? Did he have the best near-death experience out there? I asked myself these questions as Brinkley continued to pour out details about my life. I decided to wait until the next day to make my decision about Brinkley. My agent Nat Sobel and editor Diane Riverand were flying down from New York to visit with Moody and I about our next book. They both knew that I was interested in exploring the mysteries of the near-death experience through one person. I would wait until they met Brinkley before asking them if they too thought he was the right person for that exploration. I said little about Brinkley the next day when Nat and Diane arrived. They had not come to search for new book material anyway, but to discuss the book that Moody and I were working on at the time. In that regard, Brinkley was truly a fifth wheel at our discussions, an outsider at the conference table, and a noisy one at that. After a while, Nat called for a break and asked me to come outside. "Aya, who is that guy?" he asked with slight irritation in his voice. I told Nat the Brinkley story as I knew it. I could tell he was less impressed than I. "I'll just wish he at TMD zip it for a while so we can talk," he said. When we went back into the house, Diane and Brinkley were gone. "Ayo, where TMS Diane?" asked Nat. "Ayo, upstairs with Damien in my office," said Moody. "Ayo, he said he wanted to read her." Nat shook his head and sat down on a couch in the living room. He huffed with anger at the notion that Brinkley was reading Diane instead of allowing her to attend our book meeting. "Ayo, what does he do when he reads someone?" Nat asked Moody. "Ayo, well," I said Moody, his delightful southern accent coming to life. "Ayo, it's RTMS when someone who is psychic proves it by telling you things about yourself that they couldn't TMT possibly know except through supernatural powers. Ayo, how long does it take?" he asked. "Ayo, about an hour," said Moody. "Ayo, maybe more if it's RTMS a good one." Nat just shook his head. 90 minutes later, Diane came down the stairs. "Ayo, unbelievable," she said, beaming. In her measured way of talking, Diane described how Brinkley had eerie-ed her, beginning first with small talk that gradually crossed some kind of threshold into information she had never told him. Then suddenly, he was in her head and talking about people in her life and events too personal to recount among strangers, which is what we were now considered after her intimate encounter with Brinkley. "Then," said Diane, "he did something that truly blew her mind. Without touching her briefcase, he told her what was inside the buckled leather pouch. As she sat there with her mouth opened, he thumbed through her files, telling her what the different folders contained. The information was specific and accurate," she said with a note of fear and amazement in her voice. "Ayo, you have to let him read you, too," she told Nat in her convincing manner. "Ayo, it was incredible." Now, Nat was the only skeptic left in the room. He said he would let Brinkley read him someday, but with a little more coaxing from Diane, this became the day. Nat went upstairs with Brinkley and stayed for an hour. When he came back down, the skepticism was gone from his face. Without talking, we knew that Brinkley at TMS book was in our future. Within a few weeks we had signed a contract with the publisher for a book we tentatively titled A.O. Saved by the Light, and I was off to Aiken, South Carolina, to coax a book out of Brinkley. It takes more to write a good book with someone than most might think. All authors have their own way of getting into the head of a subject. My method is the saturation technique. I try to become a human sponge and soak up as much of my subject as I can. To do that requires the author to devote a lot of non-working time to the project, time in which we are not interviewing or even talking about the book we are working on, but time in which we just, well, hang out together. So with Brinkley I asked if I could stay in his house rather than in some of the comfortable hotels or bed and breakfasts that dot the quaint southern town of Aiken. He didn't TMT like that idea, he said. His home was small, he said. "Doesn't TMT matter to me," I said. He said no, and I pushed harder. "Ayo, let me sleep on the couch," I insisted. "Ayo, that way if you remember something in your sleep you can just get up and start talking." A Brinkley sighed. Somehow my persistence worked. Brinkley brought out a tattered blanket and pillow and the living room was mine. I stayed for less than a week. Looking at my notes from that first saturation period, I realize how tough it was to get inside Brinkley at EMS Head. Not only was he a complex puzzle, he was one of the Tona TMS centerpieces, and interruptions were constant. People dropped by Brinkley at EMS home just to see how he was faring. The most entertaining visitors were the ones who had been struck by lightning themselves or knew someone who had. Although Aiken is flat, it is the highest point in South Carolina and therefore invites ferry boats from those serious southern storms. We were sitting on his porch one night when a man walking by on the sidewalk stopped to talk. "Ayo, remember Jim who managed the theater?" he asked Brinkley. "Ayo, know him well," I said Brinkley. "Ayo, well, he was on the ladder changing the theater sign last week and he got struck by lightning," other man said. "Ayo, is he okay?" asked Brinkley. "Ayo, no, he at EMS dead," I said the man. Brinkley cackled in the overly cheerful way he always does when addressing Sammy only at EMS death. "Ayo, well, then he at EMS all right, eh?" he said. Within an hour of that conversation, a powerful summer storm came through and bolted the entire area with lightning. In the morning, we went to a bookstore at the local moor and were greeted by a cashier with a dazed look on her face and bright red lines that ran up her arm and across her face. "Ayo, what happened to you, darling?" asked Brinkley. "Ayo was putting money in the safe last night and the mall got hit by lightning," she said. "Ayo, guess I couldn't have been killed." Brinkley just chuckled. In addition to all the interruptions by what I came to call the Lightning Brigade, there also was the Future Brigadier people who wanted a reading from Brinkley so they could find out what was going to happen to their marriages, children, husbands, wives, businesses, etc. I was beginning to call him a lightning shaman. For instance, one day we were sitting on the bench talking about his story when a woman approached and said, "Ayo, have heard about you, Mr. Brinkley." Brinkley cordially shook the woman at EMS hand and made small talk. She wouldn't EMT leave and just kept talking and asking questions about her life that Brinkley was supposed to answer. She didn't EMT even notice me until I thanked her for stopping by. At that point she stood straight up and looked at me coldly. "Ayo, sir, we are not finished talking." Then she turned her back to me and continued talking to Brinkley. "Ayo, that at EMS what makes me not want to write this book," I said Brinkley after the woman left. "Ayo, will completely lose my privacy. I won't at EMT be able to go anywhere without being recognized and bothered. This psychic stuff is demanding. I don't at EMT think Brinkley was kidding when he said that he might not want to write this book. The thought of losing his privacy clearly bothered him. Fame is a double-edged sword, and both sides cut. Although he was compelled to tell his story, he was also afraid that it would lead to the kind of attention and scrutiny that would be painful. After all, Brinkley had been somewhat of a delinquent as a child, and he claimed a military past that was clandestine and violent. Did he really want people looking into that? "Maybe," he said, "it would be best to keep these aspects of his life in the closet." He even suggested writing a book that left out the personal story of his past. I sympathized with his position, but I had my job to do, too. I was to take what I would find out and turn it into the best story I could. From the beginning I told Brinkley what I tell everyone I write with or about: if you don't EMT want it in the book, don't EMT tell me. The genie was out of the bottle with what I knew, and there was no putting him back. I had to write what I knew if this book was going to be as good as everyone expected. This was a disturbing reality for Brinkley and our intervisor, which were kind of slippery from the beginning as they quickly lost traction completely. The tape recorder was on, but nobody was home. Brinkley was clearly preoccupied, and I was getting worried. I had 9 months to write the book and I was already getting nervous inquiries from both the publisher and my agent. Caught tightly in the middle, I chose what I thought was the smartest course of action. I left. "Ayo, where the hell are you going?" Brinkley asked on the morning he saw me packing to leave. "Ayo, we're not getting anywhere," I said. "I flew back to Arizona, where I proceeded to call both Diane Riverand and Nat Sobel to tell them that everything was going great. Then I chose another tactic. I called Brinkley and told him that I would talk to him 3 times per week on the telephone at a preset time. We had prepared a list of chapters that would be included in the book, and our goal would be to do a complete interview about each chapter in one sitting. We would talk about nothing else but that chapter until the interview was finished. This approach worked like a charm, and before long I was so wrapped up in the details of Saved by the Light that I couldn't wait for our next interview sessions. Saved by the Light is a gripping book to read, but to hear Brinkley TMS story straight from the source is an intensely powerful experience. I looked forward to our interview sessions like I would the next installment of Star Wars. The sessions took place in the evening and would usually continue into the night. Dealing with such rich material was so exciting that sometimes it was difficult to sleep after hanging up the phone with Brinkley. I had known the general story, but not the specifics, and hearing these supercharged details for the first time gave me quite the rush. For a writer, it was heaven. I think Saved by the Light is the only book I have ever completed ahead of deadline. Interviewing Brinkley and then writing from the tapes was like watching a great movie, one that would stop after several scenes and only start again when I had enough information to create more of the movie. Even though his experience had taken place more than a decade earlier, he remembered every searing moment of it as if it had happened the day before. His ability to remember had a lot to do with the fact that his lightning injuries would never let him forget. Although Brinkley is strapping and well-muscled, his heart was greatly damaged by the lightning. Within a few years of his phone call from God, one of his heart valves was damaged by a staph infection, forcing him to have it replaced with an artificial valve. This required dangerous open heart surgery that was successful, nevertheless the bacteria was persistent. I have been with Brinkley many times when the infection became so bad so rapidly that I thought he would die before he could get help. I became accustomed to it, but at first I had no idea what to do. Nor did I even have an idea that this seemingly healthy person could become code blue within minutes. It was about halfway through the writing of Saved by the Light that I witnessed Brinkley TMS mortality firsthand. He and Moody had been invited to speak at a New Age conference in Tampa. It was late in the afternoon and we were going to see a movie and have dinner. The three of us caught a cab to the theater and arrived just in time for the movie. We got our tickets and walked right into the theater. I didn't really look at Brinkley as we went in, but I did notice that his breathing seemed labored. It was dark when the movie was over, but I asked that we walk back to the hotel to get some exercise. Moody heartily endorsed the idea. Brinkley said nothing. About 2 miles into the walk, I noticed that Brinkley was not speaking, an unheard of condition for him, and was also breathing heavily. Underneath a streetlight we stopped to have a look at him. Ayo Danyan. Wertmer Blue. Ayo declared Moody. Ayo no, I said Brinkley. Ayo Yatimem dying. Ayo he laughed after he said that, but I didn't find it funny. We crossed the street to a Burger King. The restaurant was empty and the man behind the register had a look of uncertainty and fear as he watched Brinkley approach the counter. Ayo can I help you? Ayo he asked. The fluorescent lights of the restaurant showed us all the Brinkley who was as blue as a pair of Levi TMS jeans and gasping for breath. Still, the question brought out the best in Brinkley. Ayo yes sir, you can. I just want to lie down on the table and take a whopper of a nap. Is that okay? The man came out from behind the counter and wiped down a tabletop before Brinkley could cross the room. Watching him walk was like watching a climber summit Mount Everest. He would take a few steps, stop for air, and then take a few more. And no, he didn't want any help getting there. Brinkley was going to get there on his own, one step at a time. I wanted to call 911, but Brinkley would have none of it. Ayo call a cab, Ayo he said, Ayo and get me back to the hotel. Yatimem not afraid to die. I just don't want to die in a hospital. And that was that. The man behind the counter called a cab, and half an hour later when it arrived, Brinkley, struggled out of the restaurant and returned to the hotel. The next day, still ill and blue, he stood on stage and delivered a powerful speech.